24. The Boeing 737 was still undergoing customs inspection when Cabrillo and the others arrived at their rented hangar. Spencer had started to come out of his stupor a few minutes before. Adams opened the rear door of the white SUV, then waved smelling salts under his nose. Spencer shook his head several times, then cracked open his eyes. Adams helped him to his feet just outside the door of the Chevrolet. Spencer stood on the floor of the hangar on wobbly legs and tried to remember what had happened. "Come here," Adams said, leading him over to a chair alongside a workbench and seating him. With the help of Kevin Nixon, Cabrillo was erecting the folding ramp to unload the fake speaker case holding the faux Buddha. Nixon had arrived at the hangar several hours earlier and had been busy ever since.
"Is everything ready?" Cabrillo asked.
"Yes, sir," Nixon said as he grabbed one side of the speaker case. The two men rolled the case onto the wheeled metal conveyor. When it reached the end, they tilted the case upright, folded the legs of the ramp under, then bent it in half on the hinges and slid it back into the SUV.
"We have the clothes?" Cabrillo inquired. "I stopped at his hotel room on the way over. His bags were already packed," Nixon said.
"The best-laid plans," Cabrillo said, "of mice and men." Cabrillo, followed by Nixon, walked over to where Spencer was sitting. The art dealer stared up at Cabrillo.
"You look familiar," he said slowly.
"We've never met," Cabrillo said coldly, "but I know a lot about you."
"Who are you people?"
Spencer said, shaking his head to clear the fog.
"And what do you want from me?"
Adams was standing a few feet from Spencer. While his rugged good looks did not make him appear menacing, Spencer was sure that if he tried to stand, he wouldn't get far. Cabrillo walked right in front of the art dealer and invaded his space. He stared into Spencer's eyes and spoke quietly. "Right about now," Cabrillo said, "you're not in a good position, so shut up and listen. A few miles from here, you have one infuriated Asian billionaire who is convinced you bilked him out of a couple of $100 million. And contrary to what you might think, he is not a nice man. He launched his fortune by running drugs for an Asian triad, and though he's legitimized his actions, he's still connected. I would guess he's already made a call, and the entire criminal element of this country is searching for you as we speak."
"What are you—"
Spencer began to say. "You're not listening," Cabrillo said acidly. "We know you switched Buddhas and were just about to resell the icon. If you cooperate, we will give you a chance to run. Otherwise, we'll do the switch anyway, then phone Ho and tell him where you can be found. As they say, you are out of options." Spencer thought wildly for a moment. Without the sale of the Buddha, he was financially ruined. But as soon as word got around about what he had tried here in Macau, his life as an art dealer was finished. His only hope was to change his identity and disappear, escape to some faraway place and start his life anew. He truly was out of options.
"I can't run without papers," he said. "Can you help me there?"
Cabrillo had him, and he knew it. Now he just needed to reel him into the boat.
"Kevin," Cabrillo said, "are you linked to the ship?"
"Yes, sir," Nixon answered.
"Good," Cabrillo said. "Then shoot Mr. Spencer for me."
"My pleasure," Nixon said.
The last ferry from Hong Kong slowed near the dock, and the captain began manipulating the thrusters to line the ship up with the dock. On the bow, a man wearing highly polished Cole Haan loafers, a pair of lightweight wool-pleated slacks, and a silken cotton-blend shirt waited to depart. His hair was longer than usual and wavy, and tucked into his shirt was a cravat of fine silk. If you knew what to look for, the signs of a facelift were barely visible, but one would need to look close, as it had been an expensive and painstaking operation. Save for the fact that the man was exhausted from the flight from Indonesia to Hong Kong and the long day he'd already faced, you might not have noticed anything odd about him at all. The man was 45, but appeared a decade younger. He watched the deckhands secure the lines. The men were young and fit, and he liked that. He liked the ethnic look and enjoyed young men's passions. In the country where he resided, he tended to seek out companions of Latin descent. There were many where he was from, and luckily they seemed attracted to him as well. Quite honestly, he wished he was home right now, cruising the hilly streets of his city in quest for love or lust. But he was not. He was thousands of miles from home, and he had a job to do. He smiled at one of the deckhands as he walked past, but the man did not return the greeting. Slowly, the ramp on the front of the ferry lowered. Along with the few other passengers at this late hour, he made his way up the slight rise, then into a door marked Visitor. Handing over his passport, he waited as his entry into Macau was approved. 10 minutes later, he walked from the building and hailed a cab. Then he flipped open a satellite telephone and checked his email. Back on the Oregon, Max Hanley was catching a catnap. His feet were propped up on a desk in the control room and his head slumped to one side in his chair. One of the operators touched his shoulder and he was instantly awake. "Sir," the operator said, "I think we have a problem." Hanley rubbed his face, then rose and walked over to the coffee pot and poured a cup. "Go ahead," he said. "Someone flagged just passed through Macau Immigration." The corporation maintained a large database on their computers. Over the years, the names of many people had been entered. Whenever any of them cropped up on any of the numerous systems the corporation hacked into, the information was examined and analyzed. Hanley took a sip of coffee and then read the sheet of paper the operator handed to him. "We considered that possibility," Hanley said quietly. "And now he's here." Nixon walked over to Spencer, aimed at his head, and pushed the button. Then he stared at the image in the digital camera. "Can you grow facial hair?" Cabrillo asked.
"It's sparse," Spencer admitted.
"What do we got?" Cabrillo asked Nixon. "To make him look different." Nixon walked over to the bench and rustled through a box of disguises. "We've got hair, makeup, and prosthetic mouthpieces. How far do you want to go?" "It's the new you," Cabrillo said. "Where are you planning to hide?" Spencer considered the question. On the one hand, he was not interested in having anyone know his ultimate destination. On the other hand, from what he had seen so far, these people would probably find out anyway.
"I was thinking South America," Spencer said.
Cabrillo nodded. "Go with a light tan, medium matching mustache, nothing big, and slightly longer hair," he said to Nixon, who nodded and began removing items from the box.
"I know from your file you don't speak Spanish or Portuguese, so if I were you, I'd try Uruguay or Paraguay, where your British accent won't stand out as much."
Crabtree walked over.
"Why don't you have Kevin make him a Canadian?"
Cabrillo nodded.
"Here's the deal," he said.
"You do the switch for us, and we will build you a new identity. You become a Canadian who immigrated to Paraguay a few years ago and hold citizenship. We'll give you a flat $1 million to start over and a plane ticket from Hong Kong to Asuncion. What you do then is up to you and luck."
"The authorities will stop me if I try to leave Hong Kong with $1 million,
Spencer said, feeling hope.
"We'll take care of that," Cabrillo said. "Now, pick a name."
Nixon walked over and began to apply the disguise.
"Norman McDonald," Spencer said.
"Norm McDonald it is," Cabrillo agreed.
Tiny Gunderson was watching the customs officials walk through the 737 when his digital communicator vibrated. He removed it from his pocket and stared at the readout. Memorizing the message, he erased it and slid the device back in his pocket. The customs agents walked to where Gunderson was standing, then signed a sheet of paper and handed it to the pilot.
"We'll move to the fuel ramp now," the pilot said to the officials, who nodded and walked out the door and down the ramp.
The ramp was retracted, and the operator drove it away.
"Close the door," the pilot said to Gunderson.
Then he steered down the wet runway. 30 minutes later, the 737 was refueled and parked in a large hangar only yards from where Cabrillo and his team were waiting. The software billionaire dialed his satellite telephone. Hornsby, Meadows, and Jones stopped to catch their breath. All along the walls of the storm sewer, metal and tile pipes were funneling water into the main line. There was 8 inches of water on the floor of the main sewer, and it was dotted with cigarette butts, scraps of paper, and the refuse from the world above their heads.
"We're gaining an inch every few minutes," Meadows said.
Hornsby was staring at the blueprint under the light of his miner's helmet. He traced the route and stared at his compass. "I don't think the water's rising that fast," he said, "but it is a cause for concern." Jones stared around the crowded space. He didn't like being in confined spaces, and he wanted out as soon as possible. "Which way do we go, Horny?"
"We take the left passage," Hornsby said.
Inside the control room on the Oregon, Max Handley was staring at a weather radar image. A cell of clouds, the center an angry red color, was situated in the water between Hong Kong and Macau.
"Show the movement," he said to an operator.
The man entered commands into the computer, and the image moved in a slow, sweeping wave to the west. At the present speed, the storm center would pass over Macau around 4 a.m. Sometime during breakfast, the trailing edge would reach the Chinese mainland, and the weather would clear. Between now and then, there would be only rain.
"Eddie," Handley said, "I'm going to need you to take a team into the tunnel."
Eddie Seng was the corporation go-to guy. He had served in marine recon, had spearheaded more than a few corporation projects, and had an innate knack for making good out of bad. So far, Cabrillo and Handley had kept him on the sidelines in this operation. He was their reserve man in case of unforeseen circumstances, and he was itching to get into the game.
"I'll need a couple of Zodiac boats and a method of locating the men if the water keeps rising," Seng said.
"Murphy, Kasim, and Huxley," Handley said quickly. "I'll have the boats prepped and the equipment arranged. You assemble the team and meet me back here." Seng walked quickly from the control room.
"No comment," Sung Ri said, slamming down the telephone.
The reporters from the local newspapers had gotten wind something was happening. They just didn't know what. The hospital was filled with guests from Ho's party, but as the drug wore off, they were leaving one by one. Food poisoning was mentioned as the source of the guests' discomfort, but the cover story was flimsy, and someone would soon pierce through that lie. The kidnappings were being investigated. Reporters with police scanners had ensured that. The theft at the Ama Temple, the burning Peugeot, the fire at the parade, all were being investigated by reporters. Only Stanley Ho's house was sealed from them. Once he had cleared the house, he had locked the doors to outsiders. Once morning came, Ri would be compelled to comment. Just then his telephone rang again.
"The wreckage of the float is cooling, but we have yet to get close enough to inspect for remains,"
Detective Poe said.
"But my guess is they burned up in the conflagration."
"Was the float being observed the entire time?" Ri asked.
"Yes, sir,"
Poe said.
"Then find me some teeth," Ri said, "and melted gold."
"Yes, sir."
Poe stared at the firemen who were still spraying water over the twisted mess of metal. Within the hour, he would be able to inspect the wreckage. In the meantime, Ho's theft would take center stage. Somewhere in Macau was another golden Buddha, and Poe intended to find it.
"Our deal was cash," Spencer said in answer to Cabrillo's question.
Monica Crabtree was on the secure line to the Oregon. She made notes on a sheet of paper, then disconnected.
"Mr. Chairman," she said, "I think you should see this."
Nixon was doing layout on Spencer's new documents. Once he had the basic package together, he entered a command and they were sent through the lines to the Oregon, where there was a store of blank passports, immigration documents, and blank credit cards. Someone on board would print up the material and deliver it to the hangar. Cabrillo stared at the notes and handed them back to Crabtree.
"Shred them."
Tom Rise was driving at breakneck speed with Franklin Lincoln in the passenger seat. Lincoln stared at the cab dispatch records, then out the windshield once again.
"There were three cabs dispatched to the ferry dock, numbers 12, 121, and 42.
"I've been listening to the scanner," Rise said. 42 has already dropped its fare at the Hotel Lisboa. The number 12 is heading along the new road. He must be on number 121. He called the dispatcher to report that he was inbound to the Hyatt Regency on Taipa. Then he was supposed to wait for his fare and take him onward." Rise steered onto the bridge leading to Taipa. "Call Handley and explain the situation." Lincoln turned on his radio and reported to the control room.
"Give me a minute or so," Handley said.
"Access the Hyatt computer and search for his name," he said.
handing Eric Stone, an operator, the sheet of paper. "And get me a room." Stone's hands danced over the keyboard. A second later, he turned to Hanley.
"What timing?" Stone said. "He's just now checking in."
Stone waited until the data filled the screen.
"Room 2214, he said.
"Hyatt Regency, room 2214,
Hanley said to Lincoln.
"And grab him fast. If he asks the cab to wait, he's headed for the airport soon."
"Got it," Lincoln said. "Then what?"
"Bring him here."
Rise steered up the driveway to the Hyatt Regency.
"Room number 2214, Lincoln said. "We grab him and bring him to the Oregon."
Rise stopped the car and slid it into park. "You got any money?"
"Sure. What for?" Lincoln asked.
"There's the cab," Rise said, pointing. "Pay him off and tell him to leave. Then, meet me on the 22nd floor." Michael Talbot paid the bellman, then closed the door. He was due at the airport any minute, but he was grimy and decided on a quick shower. Undressing, he walked into the bathroom and adjusted the shower. Tom Rise reached into his wallet and removed a universal key card. Then he slid it through the slot and waited until the light went green. Then he slowly opened the door. At first he thought no one was in the room. Then he heard the shower running. Rise started to close the door but heard the sound of footsteps approaching down the hall. He peered out and saw Lincoln. Rise touched his finger to his lips, then motioned Lincoln inside.
"Barrett," Hanley said, "are you cross-trained in the magic shop?"
"I've worked it before," Barrett said.
"Go down there and warm up the latex machine."
"You've got it, boss,"
Barrett said, walking quickly out of the control room. Talbot was toweling himself off and trying to decide what he would wear. He stepped from the bathroom into the bedroom. A large black man was sitting at his table, and the image so surprised him that his mind was unable to process the discovery for a second. Then, from the side of the door, he felt a hand around his mouth. He was thrown face down on the bed, his eyes pressed tight against the bedspread. Next, he was quickly gagged and blindfolded, with his arms and legs secured with plastic ties. Earplugs were slipped into his ears. He could not hear Rise tell Lincoln, "I'll go find a room service cart. You stay here." Lincoln nodded and flipped on the television. Their prisoner was not going anywhere. He lay trussed like a Thanksgiving turkey, not moving a muscle. 8 minutes later, Lincoln and Rise had snuck him out a back entrance of the hotel, then brought the car around and slid him onto the back seat.
"I'm hungry," Rise said as he reached over to place the car in drive.
"Man," Lincoln said, "you always say that."